And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we have on the line with us Jean Saint-Ville. Jean Saint-Ville is a member of the Canada-Haiti Action Network, and he works with ACASAN, which involves support projects in Haiti. Jean, do I have you here with us?
Yes, I do, Brendan.
Good, very good. Jean is based in Ottawa, and I just want to let people know how fortunate we are today to have Jean on the program. He's one of maybe five people or so in Canada who have been following Haiti as closely as the key activists of the Canada-Haiti Action Network. So he's one of the most consistent activists and writers on the subject of Canada's involvement in Haiti and also the tender mercies of the international community. So again, thanks, Jean, so much for being with us. Everyone listening to this program on a regular basis knows what happened in Haiti over the last 10 years. We've discussed before how President Aristide was elected and then the coup happened. That was a second coup and a dictatorship was put in its place. And of course, that was supported by the United States, Canada, and so on. You can read all about it on the Canada-Haiti Action Network website, including articles by Jean Saint-Ville. You can read it in Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority by Eve Engler and Anthony Fenton. There's a lot of actually more work and a whole body of scholarship coming out on this, including an article in today's Toronto Star, an op-ed, which is very good. So this is something that we've covered. We've covered the coup, the torture, the UN policing, the dictatorship. You know, Jean, I mean, just when you think things can't get any worse, they do. And I guess some of the more recent outrages involve the cholera epidemic and the election. And this is something you've given a lot of focus to, especially the election. You've been covering the political process and all of the major elections and votes that have been happening or not happening in Haiti. Now, I'm not totally clear on the figures because I've received some different emails, but it seems that the international community has spent, what is it? Is it $29 or $39 million?
It's $29.6 million. I don't know how much of it is already spent, but that's what is dedicated to the election.
And Canada contributed to that as well.
Yes, $5.6 million.
Okay, almost $6 million for this election. So there's been almost $30 million put into this election. And despite that, you can read about the problems with this election even in the mainstream newspapers. But what you're not getting is the degree of disorganization, not to mention this lack of representation. Here's a few things I learned from Jean Saint-Ville and what he's been sending out and writing. Number one, I understand the names of those killed in the earthquake have not been removed from the registry, the voter registry yet, so they're still voting. Okay, some of the election stations, or actually the election stations in general, don't seem to feature the opposition candidates. There's other issues as well. I mean, the big one, of course, is Lavalas. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the most popular party in Haiti is still not on the ballot. It's still not part of the process. I mean, can you vote for Lavalas in that election?
No, you can't, because since 2004, every election that has taken place, and this is the second presidential election, and there's been other local elections, and every time the Electoral Council found a reason to disqualify Lavalas, and the way they did it this time is to say that in order to register the party, the representative of the party needs to come to a meeting. And they wrote to President Aristide, who is in exile in South Africa. And he actually has a recent interview where he explains this whole thing, where he answered, that he was, willing to come to Haiti, but he doesn't have a passport. His passport expired since the coup. As a former Haitian president, he's entitled to a diplomatic passport, and they've never issued one to him. But so he responded to the Electoral Council offering, as they asked, someone else to represent him. And he named the person, sent a letter to confirm that, and the Electoral Council said, no, we need to have it ratified. And they had it notarized by a Haitian notary, but they said, no, it needs to be with a Haitian consulate. But there's no Haitian consulate in South Africa, and the president cannot travel. So showing that the justification for rejecting Fami Lavalas is more practical than technical.
Well, it seems there's always a lot of red tape whenever Aristide or Lavalas wants to run and be elected, but there's never any red tape when the international community is selecting candidates or selecting presidents or creating political institutions in Haiti. So there seems to be a bit of an imbalance there, to say the least. Now, Aristide, if there was an election that actually involved all the people of voting age in Haiti voting for who they in their heart of hearts wanted to vote for, we would basically have Aristide as the president, right? You'd probably have Lavalas, you'd have President Aristide.
No. Let me clarify. President Aristide served two truncated terms. He was elected in 1990 and served 7 months and was deposed and was returned to Haiti in 1994 with the intervention of Bill Clinton, because the coup was organized under George Bush, who financed the CIA to conduct the coup. And Clinton entered a deal to return Aristide. But what they didn't tell the world in public is that as a condition of Aristide's return, he had to accept that the 3 years he spent in exile were part of his 5-year mandate. And according to the Haitian constitution, you cannot run two consecutive terms. So that's why in the elections that he organized in 1995, he couldn't run. He had to sit out, and the population elected Préval at the time. And after those 5 years, which means in 2000, the predictable result happened in the election. Aristide won because people, you know, they're not stupid. They realize that they've been cheated the first mandate. In the second mandate, Aristide lasted 3 years, and he was deposed by Bush the Lesser, George Bush. So what happens is that in total, Aristide served maybe 5 years. However, since he agreed when he returned that in 94 that the 3 years he spent in exile were accepted as part of his 5-year mandate, technically he's already served two presidential terms, and the Haitian constitution does not allow him to run for a third mandate. Therefore, when people are calling for Aristide's return, they're not calling for him to return as president, but rather simply to return as a citizen. And Aristide himself, in many interviews that he's given, he's always stated that his intention is to return to serve as a university professor, which he's currently doing in South Africa. But as the leader of the Famille-Lavalas party and as a charismatic leader, and also because the foreign powers, in their short-sightedness and stubbornness, have made of Aristide a martyr, a victim, he holds a lot of moral power in Haiti. So they are afraid that just by his presence on the island, if his party is not completely disintegrated as they are trying to do so since the coup, any election that takes place, Lavalas would win. But that does not mean Aristide himself would become president.
Yes, and you're absolutely right about that technicality. So certainly that's the case. And we can talk about Préval. It's a related issue. But when you mentioned the prior election of Aristide in 2000 and the coup and everything, it reminds me of the comparison or contrast that you drew between what's happening right now in 2010 and what happened in 2000 in terms of the elections. You know, this is very interesting. We talked a little bit about the foreign funding currently going into the election. But in 2000, the election that voted in Aristide, that was funded largely through Haitian sources, as through the government or through taxes, through revenues from within Haiti. It was a monitored election, a democratic election, in which Aristide won. He had quite a substantial part of the popular vote. So the election basically worked. Now, this time around, you have a lot of money being pumped in from outside, but the electoral process, as we can see, is very flawed. Now, it's hard to isolate cause from effect. I couldn't say that just domestic funding alone of the election would solve the problem, but it does seem to relate to foreign involvement generally in the election, in the coup, in the army, in the police, in the economy. So what can we learn about this election as compared to, say, the one in 2000?
Yeah, well, let's just take, for example, the interest of the population. In 2000, you didn't need to go and spend a lot of money and use strategies to go and motivate the population. The population in Haiti reacts just like the population in South Africa when there is election. I mean, people who've been suppressed and repressed, when they have an opportunity to participate in democracy, they wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning. You don't need to you know, send people there to motivate them. And it's a fallacy. You know, sometimes I laugh when I see, you know, some very young people freshly graduated from high school or university in Canada going to Haiti to motivate Haitians for elections. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, if we ever would manage to get the kind of turnout that people get in Haiti when real elections are organized, if we were able to get that in Canada, we'd be happy. The problem is not to get the people to be interested or to also, you know, ask for the intelligent questions, to know what the issues are, etc. The problem is a straight conflict of interest. The conflict is that any normal person who would run for office in Haiti would see what is evident to everybody, that the priorities of this country must be, you know, the basics, water, food security, and basic infrastructure. Because without that, all the talk about, you know, foreign investment development is just that, talk. Unless you are thinking, when you say, you know, foreign development, foreign investment, only sweatshops, or, you know, then, of course, you don't need a lot of infrastructure. Basically, you're running the place like a slave colony. And that's exactly where the problem is. Because when Aristide was elected, he was focusing on the primary needs of the people. He was focusing on increasing the minimum wage so people can have a decent wage so that if they are working, then they can see improvements from one generation to the next. And that's that was the challenge. But the 2000 election did not only elect a president. It was 7,000 elected officials. And with a slap of the hand, the United States, France, and Canada, which decided at various meetings, secret meetings, some of them, maybe with WikiLeaks, we're going to find out some of the things that happened in those meetings, they decided to overthrow the Haitian government, and they did that because they can. And because Haiti is a very fragile state, and they did that. So you ended up having convicted criminals walking side by side, Canadian soldiers, and, you know, and later on when the UN soldiers came in June 2004, and we had situations where the former Canadian ambassador, Mr. Claude Boucher, I had interviewed him. He was admitting that, you know, I was mentioning names like Guy Philippe, which is Haiti's Bin Laden. They're supposed to be, you know, one of the so-called rebel leaders that they're looking for because the U.S. say they're looking after him for drugs. But it's like the Roadrunner. They keep running after him. The guy's right there in Haiti. Everybody know him. He's giving interviews on radio. He was even a presidential candidate in 2006, but they can never catch him. So this guy, who's convicted on all kinds of crimes, including others, who were actually jailed and then was released with the complicity of the U.S. to get their training in the Dominican Republic so they could stage the coup, or, I mean, part of the coup, you know, the initial parts of the coup, they were walking hand in hand with Canadian soldiers. And the ambassador, Claude Boucher, was admitting that on video.
There's more than a few parallels to Afghanistan, for example, and, you know, when you think about it. Look at the places where Canada is running elections and start asking questions. How are those elections? How credible are they? You know, you've brought up a really important issue, and that is the West's attitude towards Haitian management of their own affairs. You've mentioned Haitians are a very democratically engaged people. They were highly motivated to participate in the election. You mentioned the 2000 election. I can also think of the time during the coup when there were processes to have elections, and later on you had lineups in Cité Soleil. People were waiting. They were willing to vote at any and all hours and line up for a very long time in difficult conditions. They were very concerned about who would be elected and how and what that meant in terms of the political process and in terms of who was elected, who was in power. They could relate that to their daily lives and were active and engaged on that basis. So you're right. We don't need to send people to motivate Haitians to vote. If we do, it calls into question why would we need motivation? And we can look at the electoral process. And I think Canada Haiti Action Network in general has pointed out that newspapers, perhaps like New York Times or major outlets, will say the election's flawed. And the idea is we should just write it off, that there's not much that can be done. They're going to need our help and our trusteeship. And it's been a similar issue in terms of the aid situation. So when you read about aid in Haiti, you say the United States, Canada gave X number of millions of dollars in aid. Why haven't things been rebuilt? Why has only 1% of the rubble been cleared? And you find out when you look into it that it's actually the aid that was given to U.S., Canadian, international organizations who were then expected to disperse or dispense that aid. So I guess the question we should be asking is, what did Canadian corporations, aid agencies do with that money? Has it been arriving in Haiti?
Yeah. I mean, it's simple. You look at the numbers, and I believe there's less than 5% of the funding that goes through the Haitian government. And the bulk of Canadian aid goes through CETA. And you can see some of the biggest numbers are related to prison and to the police. So the investment is really in repression. Now, there's a reason for that. It's not something that's done by mistake. It's the approach, and I've been saying that for years, that there needs to be a serious paradigm shift. That is, the Haitian elites, and we use that term because we don't really have a better term to use, because really you cannot really consider them elites, because they're not really transforming for the good the environment in which they live. But anyways, the moneyed people in Haiti and their foreign allies have this paradigm that they operate within, which is that the population is a threat. And as long as they consider that the population as a threat as opposed to an asset, you will see investment in prison, investment in police, when people are in front of everybody. I mean, everybody can see it. They're sleeping in the streets, no food, no water, with a cholera epidemic to fight.
And yet we can't have a government that delivers on the basics.
I mean, just look at this election, okay? So we say about $30 million was spent on the election. The presidential candidate that was associated with President Préval was flying around in helicopters. Now, do you realize that most of the people in the cities and in the countryside cannot find work? Those who do work, last year, there was a law passed by Parliament that the minimum wage, which is $2 a day, not an hour, a day, was to be raised to $5. When that was passed, the so-called private sector in Haiti, which has a lot of links with Canadian private sector and Canadian government, for instance, the company Gildan Activewear, which makes T-shirts in Canada, their partner in Haiti is André Appel, who is a white American guy who led the rebellion against Aristide, and whose brother-in-law is the white Haitian people see in the TV as one of the candidates in this election, Charlene Lee Baker. So there are a lot of links like that, and it's all business links. Now, these guys, they cried bloody murder when the parliament proposed that they move the minimum wage from $2 to $5. And the puppet president, Préval, agreed with them and vetoed a law that was already passed. So now imagine, how much does an Aquatab tablet cost for you to, you know, purify a gallon of water to save your family in Port-au-Prince? Much more than these people can earn a day.
Yes.
So even if they could survive for a day, they couldn't survive the next day. And how much would it cost to buy water purification systems and install them in many parts of the country? Because I can tell you, if you go to the Ministry of Health in Haiti, their website, for the whole weekend, they stopped counting people who died of cholera. Their recent number was in on Wednesday, and at that time it was 1,648, and then they started recounting again Monday, and they were still at 1755. That's not true. That would have meant that people stopped dying over the weekend, whereas all the studies were showing that the cholera epidemic was reaching its peak. And in the countryside in Haiti, people were dying by large numbers because there are no infrastructures in terms of health infrastructures, but there's more than that. There's no road infrastructure. So by the time someone gets to a village where there would be a clinic or to take a truck to get to the capital city, they would die. And, you know, and people we know in Haiti are telling us that this is the case. They just don't count these people.
It's shocking that with the amount of work that needs to be done in Haiti, that there's no jobs, no income for so many. Now, you called Perval a puppet president. It's quite a development because, I mean, Perval had, it seemed to me at least, been Aristide's right-hand man in a sense, and he received the support in the 2006 era election, mm-hmm. because he was seen in association with Aristide, even if he was not running on a Lavalas platform. So I guess it's been very difficult to implement change. What does Perval want to do? What can you say about his agenda?
I think he put himself in a position to be blackmailed, and you know, because there are probably mistakes that he made that they have something on him, and that makes him vulnerable.
Yes,
and obviously, there were deals made at the beginning of his election, because you realize they were trying to steal the election from him until the people took to the streets.
They made it so hard for Pervala. He had a sizable lead, and they tried to whittle that away through saying there's a regularity here, a regularity there, giving a lot of credence to his opponents. But no matter what, he had so much of the popular vote. I guess they're trying to reduce his mandate, his ability to maneuver.
Well, that was the plan from the beginning, because sometimes the discussion about Haiti get trivialized and caricatured to talk about individuals. I mean, the problem that the United States, I refuse to say international community, because, you know, it's not China or Bangladesh that has a problem with Haiti, okay? So let's be clear about it. It's the former colonial powers in Canada who wants to be in that club, that are causing the problem. And their problem with Haitian choice is that people in Haiti keep on voting for individuals that win majorities. Therefore, they become accountable to the people. They have a mandate, a clear mandate. Whereas the foreign powers are not comfortable with that. They'd rather have someone who is accountable to them, someone who is fragile. So that's why if someone wins, you know, with 20% of the vote, doesn't matter who you are. I mean, you could even have a reputation as a radical, because the economics of Haiti are such that they already control all the economy. So even if you would have ideas such as, for instance, even Breval, like, you know, he's asked for a number of times now that the UN tanks be transformed into tractors. And the UN head in Haiti, Mr. Mullet, who himself actually is under investigation in his native Guatemala for crimes against humanity, would answer Preval saying that, listen, you know, I don't have an aid organization. I run a military. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's overall, it seems that the United States, not the international community, but more directly the United States, has been appointing so many of the people responsible for the day-to-day affairs of Haiti, the people in charge, the technocrats, people in terms of ministries. So that's the level of representation. I guess that's a situation that they're trying to preserve. And so the election, they're only too happy to let it fail. What motivation do they have to let an election succeed versus failing? I guess you've suggested that the international community, or the United States in this case, is only too happy to see disillusionment or people trying to give up on democracy.
Yes, because, I mean, that is, in their assessment, that is the problem. The population is too involved in its own affairs. And so if only people would develop a sense of apathy, that would facilitate things. Again, that's the paradigm. The population is a threat. It's not an asset. And to us, we've been saying that to the to these governments, that it's a mistake that they're making, because really, it's not that difficult to get things going in Haiti with at least a minimum of compromise. At least let the people have their democratic choice, and that government, even if it's a very popular person, will have to negotiate with the foreign companies. I mean, you know, people in Haiti want foreign investment as well. But it's just that, you know, you cannot just decide to run the place like a slave plantation.
Yes.
Where, you know, people are working generation after generation, and they never get any improvement in their lives.
It seems to be the objective, you know, because, well, we only have a couple minutes left, so I won't belabor that point too much. I think certainly Haiti has a political process, and it demonstrated that in multiple elections, and Haitians want to have a functioning economy. So I don't think Haitians are the stopping point here. I think you've
Well, no, of course. I mean, to be clear, there are Haitians who are part of the problem, and I mean, they're as Haitian as everybody else. However, you know, I always say that to people, you know, I mean, if we were in a situation in Canada where some foreign power had the ability to impose on us Carla Homolka as Prime Minister of Canada, things wouldn't be pretty here, okay?
No.
So, and that's the problem we have in Haiti. I mean, you know we have corruption everywhere. I mean, Jean Charest is currently swimming in difficulties in Quebec. But nobody is suggesting that the Prime Minister of Ontario, you know, have a meeting with the Prime Minister of Saskatchewan and go and depose Charest.
No. Corruption is a term used for third world countries, developing countries, the global south. I understand that. And no matter how much corruption there is in Canada or the United States, of which there is a lot, probably on vaster scales, you know, and just in terms of difficulties and ugliness and whatnot, I mean, I wanted to touch briefly on the cholera epidemic. It's come up. You know, there's discussion, where did it come from? And that's been a sort of debate, whether it came from conditions in Haiti, whether it was introduced from outside.
Well, conditions in a poor country don't create cholera. Cholera is a bacteria. It has to originate from somewhere, and it's been isolated by the CDC experts, now by a French expert. Everybody concluded that it comes from Southeast Asia. They have the specific name of the Vibrio, and the way the contamination began at a water source right beneath the camp of the Nepalese unit that had just come from Nepal in October, where there was an outbreak in early October. I mean, all of these, plus video evidence by Al Jazeera and Associated Press, who went there unannounced and found the place where they depose excrements of the soldiers right beside the water source. It's all there. I mean, that's another stupid way of managing the situation. The UN should have very early said that we're investigating this, we're going to take measures to quarantine the place and help the families that have been affected. At that time, it was possible for them to control it. Instead, they went into public relations mode, denying. I mean, and it happens in the heels of a number of other incidents. For instance, there's this young Haitian that they hanged in the middle of that same Nepalese camp in the north. And then they claim that the man killed himself, like suicide. And that's something culturally people don't realize. People who live in very poor countries don't commit suicide, because their lives are rough from birth. People are fighting to survive, so they don't kill themselves. And if the guy was going to kill himself, he wouldn't go enter a military base and hang himself there. So obviously they're using some very stupid logic in front of the people, and that gets the people angry, and especially when they realize they don't have a government to defend their rights, and that time and again, the denial until, like, for instance, now, the French side of Radio-Canada is writing a couple of stories about the fact that a French researcher has also claimed that the cholera source is out of Southeast Asia and probably from the UN thing. But, I mean, Haitians have been saying this forever and with video evidence. And, again, it's the same racism. Until a white man says it, it's not true.
That's absolutely the case. The claims were poo-pooed, basically. It's, you know, Haitians believe it came from, they blame you.
Yeah.
It shows them demonstrating. Why are they so angry? Like, it's made to seem irrational or unreasonable when in fact...
Yeah. And then, again, like, I mean, I had an incident with CBC, Radio Canada, the French one, where they published an article with the title was 25 More Cases and Haitians Are Angry. And then when you read the article, they show you people in the streets, you know, and they never put any of the documents or the evidence that the people are using to base their accusation against the UN, rather suggesting that the Haitian people are biting the hands that feed them.
Exactly.
And I wrote back to Radio Canada and tell them, you know, this is not journalism. I mean, I'm a Canadian citizen. I've been paying taxes in this country for most of my life. You know, I don't expect Radio Canada to be a propaganda piece. You should be doing journalism. And I wrote to the ombudsman. And you know what they did? They basically stayed quiet for a while. Try to forget the story, and then later on wrote to me and said, you know, you were right, the title really didn't match the text, we kind of tried to modify it a bit, but they never cited any of the references, and what they did instead, they changed the title of the article. Instead of saying 25 more cases and Haitians are angry, they just called the title of the article 25 more cases.
It's just incredible.
This is the free press in our free country.
No, it's painting the Haitians in a certain way by omission of details, facts, context that are provided on events by Haitians. It's, again, not listening to Haitian voices, just portraying them in a certain way.
Unless the Haitian voices are echoing what they'd like to hear.
Exactly.
You know, unless it's echo. Like, for instance, I've been getting, I don't know how many interviews I've done with CTV and Radio Canada. This year, since this thing happened, CBC called me, they do a pre-interview, asked me what I'm going to say, and I decided to be frank and honest with them, and then they called me, they canceled the interview.
Okay.
Until they find a Haitian who says what they'd like to hear.
And I wanted to believe otherwise. I wanted to say otherwise and say, you know, things are starting to improve in the media. They're touching upon issues that haven't been touched upon thanks to the work of Canada Haiti Action Network. But the truth is, the same games are being played.
Every now and again, you get a brave journalist who wants to do his job and you get something out. But, you know, the status quo is the main driver. Brother, I unfortunately have to get going.
Yes, I know.
I appreciate the opportunity again.
We've kept you for a bit. This cholera thing, I didn't have those details. That's incredible. But I know there's other issues, and we can catch up upon that next time. But
anytime.
Thank you so much, John. People can find your articles on the Canada Haiti Action Network website?
Yes, some of them, and then, yes, absolutely.
Okay, I will direct people to that. Thanks so much,
Thank
John.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.